Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast that puts the F in Schedule F. I'm Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and returning special guest star, Reason senior editor Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Happy Nick Gillespie birthday week and day, everyone.
Woo!
I think I get to go last, but I guess not today.
My happy birthday. Monday, everybody.
That's it? That's all you're going to give your treasured colleague, Nick Gillespie, as he turns a magical age?
Yeah.
Peter Suderman.
What?
Enough. Already done.
The humanity. All right,
let's just get after the podcast portion of this podcast. Last Tuesday, former President Donald Trump was indicted on four counts related to his efforts to change the results of the 2020 presidential election, which he lost.
I think you just lost a couple of us. I know I blacked out there for a second.
That's fine. If you're going to be taking birthday prerogative, we got
I'm trying to make a joke,
long
Matt.
Long slog it's, ahead of
yes,
us.
Yes, it's Monday. There's another Trump indictment, right?
Yeah. So those counts are an attempt to defraud the United States by trying to prevent the counting of ballots and certification of the results, an attempt to obstruct and impede the vote certification process in Congress and conspiracy thereof, and finally, a conspiracy against the right to vote and to have one's vote counted. This case, as Birthday Boy was alluding to, is the third of an expected four criminal proceedings brought against the overwhelming frontrunner in the GOP's 2024 presidential primary. The first was a business fraud indictment in New York over activities related to hush money payments to adult performer Stormy Daniels. The second in Florida concerns Trump's handling of presidential records and requests to return them. And the fourth, which is widely expected to come down over the next couple of weeks in Georgia, has to do with the then president leaning on elected officials there to change the statewide results of that election. This latest case, as Reason senior editor and spectacular last week roundtable guest Jacob Sullum has persuasively argued, hinges on whether Trump actually believed he fairly won the presidency or not. If he didn't, then he was knowingly pursuing a corrupt conspiracy to do crimes, they say. If he did believe, then the criminal intent becomes much harder to prove. There's also a free speech contention in this case, and I want to belatedly start our conversation there, Nick. The former Libertarian Congressman Justin Amash, no fan of Trump, super big fan of free speech, tweeted over the weekend that the indictment attempts to criminalize Trump's routine misstatements of fact and law, and that, quote, it endangers all Americans to begin treating politicians' false beliefs regarding political or constitutional matters as criminal offenses. On the other side of the free speech debate, we have American hero Walter Olson, who writes, quote, it is long established and ordinarily uncontroversial that speech can lose the protection of the First Amendment if it solicits or facilitates crime, end quote. Wake up, Nick Gillespie. Whose side do you take in the Amash Walter Olson civil war?
Yeah, that's, I'm looking forward to them. They're the undercard when Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg duke it out. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to side. I'm going to go off the table, Matt, and say I don't care. I think both of them make spectacular points. I agree with what Wally Olson talks about. And he was a recent live stream at Reason Guest. That'll be in the show notes. He's always good on these matters, but. You know, conspiracy consists mostly of speech, and there's certain types of speech. When you conspire to commit a crime, it's not protected by the First Amendment. So, you know, in theory, obviously Trump can be, accused and convicted of, conspiring using speech, right? And there's a, there's a compelling case, at least in the indictment, that that's what's going on here. We'll see if it goes to trial and what happens and things like that. On the other side of the ledger, I think Amash is right that, this is a lot of it hinges on trying to read the mind of Trump and the people around him. I think that Trump, you know, knew that he, you know, he was trying to overthrow the return, you know, an election. I don't think that much is going to be served ultimately by bringing him to trial and things like that. And I think about this more from a kind of sociological or even mythopoetic, you know, perspective. And it's not Trump has acted worse than basically any previous president in terms of like pettiness and in terms of saying, you know, doing the things visibly that maybe a lot of them did invisibly. And I kind of thank him for that, because I think that's an important, you know, kind of understanding of how power operates. But I think it's a bad thing if he is indicted, not if he's indicted, but if it goes to trial, you know, this isn't good. And it's not going to get us to having the political conversations that we need to have, which don't include Donald Trump or the kind of attempt to, you know, finally blot him out of the public consciousness.
Peter, last week you were doing the a bit of a Hamlet act on this prosecution, preventively or preemptively, as we were looking forward to it perhaps happening. So given the so-called solemn hinge of intent, how does any of that change your position after reading the indictment, and perhaps particularly the moment that put a pause in my step, where an advisor warns the president, like, hey, if you stay in office and don't refuse to hand over power, there might be riots in the streets. And Trump allegedly says, well, that's what the Insurrection Act is for. How does that change the Sudermanian calculations?
So it wasn't Trump who responded, that's why we have the Insurrection Act. Actually, it was co-conspirator number four, and I don't have the list up in front of me. But it was one of the crank lawyers that, you know, or political aides that Trump was involved with, not Trump himself. So reading the indictment, and I would encourage everybody who is interested in this and who wants to actually develop an informed opinion, read the indictment. It's 45 pages, but it's a quick read. They've done a nice job of actually laying out a bunch of specifics. I don't think any of the factual statements, sort of allegations in this are in dispute, really. I mean, it's pretty solid just as on a factual level. And I think, you know, the first thing I want to address is the speech question, because that's really interesting. It is true that basically everything that Trump does in the indictment, everything you see him doing, is saying stuff. And I have said on this podcast in the past that politicians and the legal system sort of has essentially no business policing stuff that people say. But I think you can make a different case in this instance. And I think it is at least possible to understand this not primarily as a case about speech, but as something else, as about an attempt to induce a crime. And one way of thinking about this might just be to do a little bit of kind of partisan scenario flipping here. Imagine a Democratic official of some sort, say in Chicago, who tries to convince another elected official, I don't know, an elections official or a city council member, somebody like that, to engage in some sort of shady activity, the result of which would be to overturn a legitimate election, right? And the initial official who we're talking about here didn't do anything him or herself, didn't do anything except say stuff, say, hey, you should do this. Hey, you should go ahead and, I don't know, switch these boxes out, right? Like we're going to, or eliminate, you know, get rid of those paper ballots or not count them or whatever it is, or replace them with something. All that person did was speak. But I think we can all agree that that sort of behavior is potentially criminal. It is not necessarily protected speech. Now, one can also say here that if Trump truly believed, if he had a good faith belief that the election results were illegitimate and that the election was being stolen, then most of the things he did should at least be legal, even if you can say they were of dubious judgment or quite poor judgment in some cases. Because if you are attempting to write an election, right, if you are attempting to set it right after it has been stolen from you, then that's, of course, perfectly reasonable to do. At the same time, Trump should have known. He simply should have known. You read this indictment. This is the thing that comes across most clearly to me, is that if you read this indictment,
There is no way that a reasonable, halfway intelligent person could have avoided knowing that what they were doing was, at the very least, crazy and unsupported by any evidence, and probably quite illegal. And I would point people to paragraph 63 that describes a meeting with Trump and a bunch of the other folks who are involved in the plot to replace legitimate electors with fake electors. And they're talking about how they're going to do this. And everybody in the room is like, well, maybe we can do this. But absolutely no one in this room wants to put their name on what they're going to do. They're all just like, no, we're not signing our names to this. Because as one of them says, and this is a quote in the indictment, a senior advisor wrote, certifying illegal votes. Not just certifying votes that are like, this is an alternative theory votes, certifying illegal votes. That was known amongst every person in the room, with the exception, we don't know, maybe. Did Trump know that or did he not know that? Certainly he was told that. And you just see over and over and over again that reasonable people, even pro-Trump officials, all throughout this indictment, pro-Trump officials are like, we are not going to do that because there is no evidence for this. To do so would be unconstitutional or illegal and just a very, very bad idea politically. So maybe somehow or another, Trump is such a crazed, whatever, a mentally unstable person that he somehow or another still believed the election was stolen from him and that what he was doing was legitimate. But if that's the case, then the case you have made is that Trump should not, under any circumstances, have been president or be president again. Because if he didn't know, then he is a delusional maniac with incredibly poor judgment. So either Trump engaged in a deliberate and knowing conspiracy to upend a legitimate election, or he's a delusional maniac. Those are the only choices you have after reading this. Like, it's one of the two.
False choice.
So is that a yes or a no?
Yeah, exactly.
I think you can believe either of those things, what you can't believe coming out of this is that Trump reasonably and in good faith believed that the election was stolen from him. You can believe that he believed it because he's a freaking crazy person, but you can't believe that it was a reasonable belief.
You got to believe, Matt. I think I'm not the only Mets fan on this podcast.
In fact, you
are. Liz, are you still planning on naming your baby after Donald Trump? Or are you waiting to see what's in the fourth indictment?
I ask the questions on this podcast, Nick Gillespie.
Liz, what are you naming your baby, Matt?
And you had to be, I think, first or second off the jump at Reason because of your heroic work on the daily morning roundup or whatever we call it. So what did you learn or get reminded of to your chagrin reading the indictment and the sort of reactions thereof?
So with my roundup, I kind of took the cop-out approach, which was like, here's what people are saying, because I had not really, formulated an opinion yet or had time to digest it. So I presented, the arguments that this was, a bad idea, that this implicated free speech, and also some people saying that it didn't. And I regret to say that I haven't really gotten away from that, which is sort of the same place that Nick and Peter both are. I mean, I agree with everything that they said, which is that, I read people making arguments that this is a bad idea, and I kind of agree. And then I read people making arguments that, they're perfectly well within the legal parameters to bring this. And I think that that's right too. I think maybe, someone had, Joe Bishop Henchman, a former LP guy, he had tweeted in response to Amash's tweet that Amash was making a political argument, not a legal one, about whether or not these charges were wise. And I think that makes sense to me. And I think that's, a lot of where the sort of, confusion here is because like there's two separate questions. It's like, do they have a right to bring these charges under the statutes that they brought them under? And I think unquestionably, yes, they do. I mean, whether or not that they will succeed, as Walter Olson mentions in his post, whether or not they will succeed is a different question. But the statutes they are bringing these things under are are legitimate. They have been applied to similar conduct, albeit not by, you know, the president of the United States, but they have been applied in similar situations. It's not totally crazy that they, you know, chose these statutes. The question of, you know, whether it is a political precedent that we want to set to sort of to criminalize, and it's hard too, because it's, you know, to criminalize what some people would call a coup attempt, everyone will say, well, like, yeah, but then when you put it like Peter did, and like Jacob had mentioned, you know, to criminalize maybe someone's delusions and someone's speech about those delusions is a different matter. So I guess my very convoluted answer here is just that I'm very conflicted, or the positive spin on that is nuanced. I can see sort of the arguments for and against this. And I do like, though, that I'll just add that I do like that, you know, but Nick's response, Peter's response, what Jacob wrote, all of us here, you know, I think we are kind of an exception in that we are willing to apply a nuance to looking at this. You know, you see so many people that have just looked at this and they're either like, ah, this is, you know, this is a witch hunt, this is weaponization of the political process, or they're like, yes, this is totally necessary because this was insurrection and it must be punished. And I think I'm happy to work at a place where we're willing to sort of look at this from many different angles and see how it could be viewed differently depending on things we don't know, like about Trump's mindset.
Birthday boy, you said, I'll summarize your previous remarks as you thanked Donald Trump for being the worst president ever.
No, that is not what I said, actually.
I know I'm okay. I'm having fun at your expense because it's your birthday and I get to. But no, you thanked him for sort of surfacing in public things that might be, et cetera, et cetera. So on that kind of tip, Trump posted on, I think, Truth Social on Friday.
Does that really exist, by the way?
I don't know.
I think I tried to create an account the first day it was announced and failed and have not been back.
I think that's a you problem, not a Truth Social problem, but I'm not sure. It would definitely be a me problem if I had tried and failed, because that's what we would expect. Anyways, Trump, the former president, said, if you go after me, I'm coming after you.
All right.
Said that on Friday, which prompted the prosecution to seek some kind of protective order that's going to be looked at about evidence, not about their personal safety so far.
He's running out of bathrooms, Matt. Where is he going to hide his documents next?
Other Trump reactions that he's had on his so-called social media have included over the weekend that Nancy Pelosi is a sick and demented psycho who will someday live in hell. And then also on this one.
By the way, isn't she going to be the ambassador to the Vatican? That's as close to hell as you can get on this, you know, on God's green earth.
Wow. I'll give you a birthday pass for defaming our the whole something or other.
The vicar of Christ on Earth, Matt Welch. The representation of Dagon the fish god, the leader of the world's biggest cult.
Another Trump quote, I am calling for a federal takeover over this filthy and crime-ridden embarrassment to our nation. It seems that he was referring to the criminal trial or the court or the judge or something in that thing. Does his behavior, his reaction to this stuff, his sort of ongoing Trumpness, does it, Nick Gillespie, sort of justify the Democratic Party and their supporters' ongoing contention that if we have an election and Trump is one of the candidates, the prospect of Trump winning is a serious threat on the constitutional order of the United States of America?
Yeah, absolutely not. And this, going through the conversation that we just had, I want to, you know, I think I had concluded that this was not a good idea to, pursue a prosecution against Trump. And I'm hardened in that, Matt, just by this conversation and by your recitation of recent facts, because if the Democrats want to get rid of Donald Trump, the best thing that they can do is run against him again. He is a loser president. He's the Adlai Stevenson of the 21st century. He is not going to get more than 47% of the popular vote under any circumstances. What I had said before, and I stand by, what I like about him is that he makes visible the way in many ways that power operates. He's very sloppy and crude and very transparent. And that's helpful. And I'm not saying that all elected officials or all presidents are equally scuzzy and all of that kind of stuff or self-interested. But like, he's the perfect president for the end of an era in American politics that we desperately need to get past. And I don't think we're going to get past it as quickly as we could by simply, starting to have conversations about what are the policies that we need. Joe Biden, I mean, the Republicans are giving Joe Biden a pass. He is a bad, awful president whose policies suck, who helped create inflation, who is promising long-term slow growth because of his spending policies and priorities and things like that. And we're not having those arguments. We're not having those discussions. And the new people who need to emerge, from this really terrifying gerontocracy that we're living under, as long as it's between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, we're not going to be having any of that kind of disputation. That's really what's necessary.
Speaking of policies and Trump, we are going to get to a policy question regarding Trump from a listener in a little bit. That's just a tease. That's a little foreshadowing here that we're doing. So let's shift topics. Let's let Nick Gillespie have birthday privileges of having the last word on that. And let's go to a topic that is grim. Last week, Jim Larkin, the longtime publisher of the New Times chain of alternative weekly newspapers that emanated out of Phoenix, Arizona, originally, and co-founder of the online classifieds service, since shuttered now, but called Backpage, which has faced serial prosecutions from the federal government over alleged facilitation of prostitution. Jim Larkin killed himself last week, shot himself to death on the eve of his and his partner Mike Lacy's federal retrial. It had been kicked out in 2021. This was scheduled to begin this week. Elizabeth Nolan Brown has been covering this trial better and more than any other journalist in America, and wrote a very great teeth-clenched piece about that last week at Reason. Liz, can you update us about where the status of the trial and kind of the fallout from Larkin's suicide is? And then perhaps maybe just to tee it up for listeners who haven't followed this case that closely, why should people who are maybe not super huge fan of online prostitution facilitation sites, why should they care about this case? What are the implications that are of interest to our free-mindsy and free-marketsy people out there?
Yeah. So the judge, after Larkin's death, ruled that the case must go on, issued an order saying the case must go on as planned and start on August 8th. It's supposed to start tomorrow. Then during a hearing on Friday, did issue an extension through the end of the month. So now it's scheduled to start on August 29th. So gave them a little bit more time. Larkin's suicide is just the latest, really tragic outcome of this prosecution, which has been full of sort of injustices at every step of the way. And I will note too that this is not the first time that the government has driven someone to suicide, seemingly driven someone to suicide by prosecuting them for facilitating prostitution ads. I wrote about a case back in 2016 for Reason of them taking down the federal government and Seattle government and cops taking down the review board out in Seattle, and the proprietor of that site ended up killing himself also. When you think that this combines some really horrible things, which is not just the fact that you are being prosecuted and, you have this hanging over your head and you are facing, jail time and all sorts of penalties. And in the case of the Larkin and the other Backpage executives, that they had all their assets taken from them, a lot of their assets taken from them and seized without any being able to get any hearings on it. So they've just been, really struggling to pay their lawyers and to get by. But then also you have people calling you a sex trafficker, and you have like that being your reputation in the government. And I think that just adds this whole other horrible layer to things.
Not just people, like senators, current vice presidents, for example, accusing you of facilitating modern slavery, of building an entire business knowingly on child prostitution. That was a Claire McCaskill quote, if I remember correctly.
Right. And, you know, they had the first trial in September 2021 of Larkin and Michael Lacey, who founded Backpage together, and the other execs. It was declared a mistrial because the prosecutors and their witnesses would not stop mentioning child sex trafficking, even though that is not what this case is about. They are not accused of child sex trafficking. There's no ads that are, you know, part of the indictment against them that involve it. It involves facilitating prostitution. So it's, you know, the government is really tried, despite the fact that this is not actually a sex trafficking case, to make this appear to be a sex trafficking case. So to get, you know, to get to your second question there, the you know, essentially Lacey and Larkin and the other defendants are on trial for providing a platform for free speech. And that is why, you know, that is what Larkin said all along, that they were on trial for facilitating free speech. And they had been, you know, him and Lacey were, you know, newspaper guys. They had owned, you know, 18 different papers at one point. They have been going into court and fighting the federal government over First Amendment issues since the 1970s and just doing that for decades. So that kind of, I think, is, you know, really important context about why that they were so adamant about this, you know, fighting this charge and not, you know, taking a plea deal or not just like giving in before they were even arrested and stopping allowing adult ads, because they knew that this was protected speech. Basically, you know, the government says no, that these were all ads for illegal prostitution and therefore they were, you know, committing a crime. But they say, you know, escort, they had an escort section. They had ads for strip clubs. They had ads for various things. In addition to, you know, all the ads for like jobs and, you know, someone selling a couch or whatever. And you know, those are protected forms. Those are legal forms of sex work, and advertising for them is protected speech. And if people then in private ended up doing illegal activities, like that is not their, you know, their business. And so I think, you know, the whole crux of their argument hangs on the fact that they're like, we have sex workers have a First Amendment right to advertise. Backpage had a First Amendment right to provide a platform for those advertisements. And that is what the government is going after them for.
Peter, you've covered Section 230, as has Liz, over the years a lot, the provision of the 1996 Communications Decency Act, that is referred to sometimes, mostly by us, but other people, as the kind of First Amendment of the internet. It's under, and has been, and we've talked about this in this podcast a lot, kind of bipartisan attack in different ways, but the attack pressure has been the same in Washington for the past several years. And in fact, Backpage is kind of part of that story. People were upset, prosecutors and politicians were upset that Backpage basically was able to, up until now, successfully fight off most prosecutions by citing Section 230, which, as Liz was sort of referring to there, it allows for third-party transactions between people in which the initial provider of the platform is not legally responsible for. So maybe ask you to gaze into your either crystal ball or more like looking at the current regulatory / political environment as concerns Section 230 and kind of things like that. Are we likely to see in the future more prosecutions like this? Is there going to be a weakening? Has there already been a weakening of the way that that law, the 1996 law, protects third-party speech?
Yeah, so the first thing to say here is that there's just a generalized misunderstanding, and frankly, more than a misunderstanding, often I think an intentional misrepresentation of what Section 230 does. And a lot of the controversy over that stems from that misunderstanding or misrepresentation. Section 230 doesn't give big platforms a liability shield that allows them to break the law. What it does is it says that online, you don't have responsibility for speech that somebody else makes. Like, that's it. And that's you and me. If you start a blog and it's got a comment section, that's Facebook. If they start Facebook and they've got a billion users, that's all of the org that's online. You don't have responsibility. You don't have legal liability for somebody else's speech. That's what it says. And, you know, And so much of our like sort of complaints about Section 230 are like, oh, this gives big operators a legal shield so that they can ignore terrible illegal sex trafficking activity. And then again, so much of it is also not sex trafficking. A huge amount, possibly even essentially all of the complaints about sex trafficking are actually just complaints about adult prostitution. Consensual adult prostitution. And you see that so often just in the cases that Liz Nolan Brown has written up. And then I think the other thing that you should look at if you're trying to think about this question is what has happened with FOSTA, which is the FOSTA SESTA, which is the Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, right? Which is a sort of internet speech law aimed at combating online sex trafficking. And there's just like, it was obviously that law was obviously not going to be valuable when it passed. It was obviously just going to chill speech when it passed. And then a couple of years after it passed, so it passed in 2018. In 2021, the Government Accountability Office, you know, not like a sex worker rights foundation. The Government Accountability Office went and looked at this and basically was like, well, it doesn't seem to be helping in any of the sex trafficking prosecutions that are going on right now. If anything, it's made things a little bit worse because it's because the sort of the honest middlemen and sort of the people who are operating basically in a reasonable legal zone, right, and just trying to run websites, they've been cut out of the picture. And this is one of the things that is so remarkable about the case against Backpage. And Liz Nolan Brown, I will just continue to cite your work here because it's incredibly revealing and like I have, you know, followed it with great fascination over the years, is that when you go back and you look at internal communications about what the feds were saying about Backpage. Again, the feds, not like, I don't know, not even like sex workers themselves, but the federal agents were like, yes. So Backpage has been an incredibly valuable resource for fighting off actual child sex trafficking, because to the extent that it is happening on their platform, like they're trying to get rid of it. They're surfacing this stuff. They're to us. They're sending it. They're being extremely cooperative. And what has happened without Backpage? Well, the feds no longer have that resource. So the people going after the actual bad guys now have lost a tool, lost a communications partner that was trying to get this stuff offline and trying to make and trying to make the situation better. And at the same time, sex workers, things have gotten much worse for them because they are now operating outside in forms that are just a lot dicier and a lot more dangerous. And so everything is worse because of the war on Backpage. There is not one single thing, not even the specific goals that that the politicians and legal officials who have been pursuing this, not one thing that they said about, oh, we're going to go after Backpage has gotten, you know, like nothing, none of their goals have been achieved. And everything has gotten worse for everyone involved. It has just been a travesty of justice for throughout. And now Liz, I can see, wants to say something.
Yeah. Just to add, I mean, I think another thing that I think is just really important to add in the Section 230 thing is that it doesn't, you know, a lot of the times the speech that's in question, it's not Section 230 that fundamentally protects it. It's the First Amendment. But Section 230 is a legal tool that helps tech companies and anybody, you know, with an online platform avoid having to go into a really long, costly court battle over it. Over their First Amendment rights, because Section 230 is sort of a shortcut, like, to protect them. So of course, you know, politicians have wanted to get rid of it for a long time, for just because, you know, it makes it harder for them to yell at people and say, you got to take down the speech, because then, you know, they can't just force people into a really long court battle or to just do it. So Backpage was really a test case. You know, they conjured the worst thing they could think of, child sex trafficking, and accused Backpage of it and said, we're going to, you know, go after them and we're going to pass FOSTA because that people won't ask too many questions if we just say this is all about child sex trafficking and we get to amend Section 230 that way and sort of go around it this way. And then you've seen in the years since FOSTA passed and years since they've been demonizing Backpage that they've taken this exact same playbook and applied it to every other tech company on the internet and used every other excuse. You know, now it's like terrorism, guns, political bias, hate speech, whatever. They've used all the same, you know, things that they accused this being about child sex trafficking to try and expand their you know, carve outs of Section 230. So I think really, you know, the way to look at FOSTA and Backpage and Section 230 is like they used this to see what they could get away with. And when they saw that they could get away with it in this front, it's really, it's just expanded to every other form of online speech over the past, you know, 5 years.
Nick, I have been perhaps naively shocked by how little over the years it feels like the kind of journalistic free speech establishment has identified the serial prosecutions of Lacey and Larkin, the late Jim Larkin now. Wonder if you have any kind of theories. Do you think this is sort of like a technophobic thing that overlaps with Ross Ulbricht, you know, rotting in federal prison for no good goddamn reason? Or even, you know, speaking of people who just died, Kevin Mitnick, like a 1990s hacker, sadly just died of, I think, of a heart attack or an untimely demise, but he was hauled up because he was a hacker and hackers were scary and they were doing hacking things. Do you have a theory about this?
Yeah, it's you're right to focus on the lack of support from journalists and from media outlets and platforms about the Backpage case and related issues. It is deeply disturbing. And, you know, Matt, there's not a lot of reasons to be proud to be a journalist other than, you know, we're like truffle pigs. We can find free food and open bars, you know, with like an uncanny, you know, sixth or seventh or eighth sense or something. But I think the reason for it is partly in the Backpage case, it's because these guys were publishers. And you remember, like, the New Times, you know, and it's like nobody's perfect, but the New Times helped keep alt weeklies alive probably for a decade or two more than it would have. But they were seen as enemies by a lot of the people who wrote for them, and especially a lot of the people in more established or legacy media. And so for the same reason that Craig Newmark was a villain, because he came up with a better ad platform like Backpage with Craigslist. And Craig Newmark now, you know, to, I guess, his credit, you know, he has a journalism school named after him. So he's made peace in a way that the Backpage guys weren't going to. But I think there's two things going on here. One is that legacy media, even when it's mostly online, hates people who are disruptors and innovators in ways that really force you to change your business model and to recognize, yeah, you know, because it's a canard or a cliche to say, oh, you know, we have to protect the speech stuff that we don't agree with or we don't like. You know, these guys kind of force you to do that. Not because they weren't into child sex trafficking or prostitution, but they were taking money away from old style newspapers. And they were actual free speech activists in a way that all journalists pretend to be, but very few are. So I think you have that broad part of this story, why people, journalists don't care about this as much as they should, is they are disruptors, and journalists, you know, don't like to be disrupted. They are lazy fucks who just want to keep doing things however they showed up. You know, when they showed up, that's journalism at its peak. Anything that changes that makes, you know, is bad for business, right? And is bad for the profession.
I mean, I do love the mid-aughts blog era. It was pretty great.
Yeah. I think the other aspect of it is that journalists increasingly, and I'm thinking about this, the response to the Twitter files and to the Facebook files and the absolute collusion going in both directions, sometimes through a revolving door of personnel and whatnot, but between major media platforms and the government at all levels to say, this is okay speech, this is bad speech, hey, you know, this type of stuff. There is a broad segment of the media, you know, establishment, I don't know what you want to call it, the legacy media, whatever, who really believe, partly because of Trump, but it was trending before that. It was when Bush Hitler took power, you know, by fixing the Supreme Court or, you know, or rigging those Diebold machines in 2004 in Ohio, that we are in a existential fight. I was saying Andrew Sullivan, who doesn't fit into most of these categories, but he's still talking about threat level extinctions to liberal democracy because of Donald Trump and because of Sarah Palin, you know, didn't share her gynecological records and things like, you know, like there most journalists believe that they are like, you know, Charles Martel, and they are the only thing that's holding us from total, you know, fascist overthrow, blah, blah, blah. And they've taken sides, and they didn't like the Backpage guys because the Backpage guys weren't the type of free speech person they wanted. They didn't like Ross Ulbricht, you know, a fucking Eagle Scout who was into Bitcoin and freedom and whatnot, and then got prosecuted for stuff that is very different than what the government talked about when they were prosecuting him and things like that. And I think those two, you know, those two dynamics are the things that help explain what absolute jerk-offs and no-shows most journalists have been. And it's, you know, it's particularly sickening when you see an old man, you know, shoot himself in the head rather than, you know, face an endless array of prosecutions until he dies of natural causes.
I'll just add to Nick's analysis there that the New Times people created adversaries. They threw sharp elbows. They came in and looked at the sort of alt-weekly graybeards, the Village Voice types, and just mocked them for being like crusty, smelly old hippies who didn't ever get anything done and never like overturned government malfeasance. And then on the other hand, they would go after whatever the local dominant daily newspaper was. So kind of they threw elbows to the left and to the right. And as a result, were just always given descriptors that did not resemble them at all, especially after 9/11. They were constantly called neocons, which is insane. They literally got their start by opposing the Vietnam War in like 1970, and they just were not neocons. It doesn't explain anything. So yeah, and then that notion, Nick, that you're talking about, in addition of like, you know, we have to be against speech we don't like, it's, do we like the person speaking? Yes or no? And if we don't, then suddenly we can look the other way. If they're on the good team, then they must be defended at all costs. This is really gross development ongoing over the last 20, 25 years. And I think it's a big part of the kind of journalistic fleeing from a lot of free speech wars, which we've seen in a lot of different areas, including with Charlie Hebdo and other things. We decided we didn't like Charlie Hebdo, even though they got assassinated because they were punching down.
They were punching down to people who came and shot them to death. You know, they brought words. They brought a pen to a gunfight. Right. And they didn't know it. It's sickening. Matt, very quickly, though, yes. the end of what might be called like the alt-weekly era or something, which, you know, kind of starts with the Village Voice around in the mid 50s when it was created. And then it died sometime maybe in the mid aughts or the late aughts or the early teens. And it's a real loss. And I say this as somebody who grew up reading the Village Voice in the, I guess, the late 70s and early 80s and the New York Press and the New York Observer. And then, you know, college newspapers and things like this, like real alt media that was just started on like, you know, a shoestring budget and a couple of fever dreams and things like that all over the place. Multi-source benefited from ever cheaper technology and distribution methods, including online. It is a real loss, not simply because those things aren't around anymore, but it was a breeding ground for different sensibilities that then came to inform the mainstream in a bold and powerful way. Reason is part of this movement too. And, you know, it's awful that this has died and that now there is like almost a kind of, you know, screen wipe of what all of that did. Obviously, you have written about this a lot, Matt, and you've lived this, you know, more than most of us, I think, including starting papers in foreign countries, you know, post-communist countries. And it's really bad because, you know, this, and I don't want to call them minor leagues, like, you know, this is for people who can't make the majors. This is where you start out. Like if you take something like, you know, Washington City paper out of the mix, you lose it. So many, like, it's a Wonderful Life. Suddenly so many great people you don't identify with alternative weeklies, all of that and all of their experience, their coaches tree just disappear in the mainstream media, and we're all just left so much worse off because we have like this dead monoculture of dumb journalism, which is just not what we need in this country now or forever.
And that's how you got the situation with the reporting on sex trafficking in the U.S. and the reporting on Backpage, because there is this dearth of of sort of non-groupthink outlets out there. I mean, arguably the fact that there are less alt weeklies or things with their spirit is part of why the coverage of Lacey and Larkin was always so bad, because there wasn't this independent voice out there to defend them anymore.
All right, let's get to our listener email of the week in a moment. But first, friends, who doesn't have a whole movie franchise's worth of horror stories about the health insurance industry? For instance, there's that one time I left one job on a Friday afternoon and took another one on Monday morning so as not to disrupt my health coverage too much. The workplaces had the exact same provider, and yet my coverage was disrupted for 2 months, during which time I was paying outrageous COBRA rates, and my wife got pregnant and I hurt my knee, had to go to the Curl and Job Clinic, Nick Gillespie, all of which cost me several thousand dollars more than I would have paid had I enjoyed a different system for the provision of health-related services. Crowd Health is that system. Do you see little periods after each word there in all caps? You just pay $50 a month, get access to telemedicine, discounted drug prices, and more. None of this in-network mumbo-jumbo or coverage gaps or COBRA bites. You get your own personal care advocate. Enjoy peace of mind about unexpected medical emergencies. Also, $50 a month. It's time you opt out of restrictive health insurance plans and let Crowd Health help fit your healthcare needs. Get started today for just $50 a month. Use code ROUNDTABLE to get the healthcare you deserve. Please note, the Crowd Health is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com. That's joincrowdhealth.com. Code Roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder, email your snappy queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Simon Chinkle. Thank you for the pronunciation guide, Simon. Who writes, recently, I was blindsided by a Trump-hating friend who shared with me information on Trump's Schedule F, an executive order from September 2020, by the way, which, quoting an NBC News story, which was shared with me, would reclassify tens of thousands of federal employees involved in policy decisions as at-will employees. In other words, they would lose their employment protections and it would be much easier for a president to fire them, end quote. I read the news article and didn't have a clear understanding of whether this executive order was a good thing because it could potentially reduce the size of the federal workforce, or a bad thing because of the potential of installing a perpetual cycle of defenestrations of government workers being replaced by sycophantic yes men and women. Your discussion of the pros and cons would be most illuminating. Suderman, you live in Washington. What say you?
Yeah. So anybody who lives in Washington probably knows maybe even several federal employees, for example, has brunch with HUD staffers and, you know, people who work for the DOJ, just, you know, kind of every now and then, right? And if you know that, like, if you have brunch with those people, you will discover that the thing they do is just complain about their colleagues. The career civil servants.
That's so, I couldn't understand that.
Yeah. The career civil servants constantly complain that everybody else in their department doesn't do their job, like barely shows up for work, is just a pain in the butt to work with, like is slow, is lazy, kind of stupid, right? Like they don't quite say, man, I think bureaucracy is bad, because they all identify as bureaucrats, but they help you understand the reason why the word bureaucracy is often considered an insult, right? It's slow and it's tedious. Like it sort of appeals to the lowest common denominator. It's an obstacle to good, swift work, right? And so I will just say, almost independent of like my policy, you know, my ideological priors, like just from the civil service brunches, my opinion is the federal bureaucracy needs to be smaller and more flexible. It's filled with a lot of people who don't really do the job very well and probably don't need to be in the employ of the federal government at all. But I'm not sure Schedule F would get us there. And, you know, Matt, in the Slack beforehand, you shared a great piece in Axios by Jonathan Swan about the origins of Schedule F and sort of the desire on the Trump administration to build this program. And like, it's really quite clear from the reporting here that the Schedule F system was built not to have a better, smaller, more agile bureaucracy, but instead to have one that is more loyally partisan, more politically motivated, and specifically more MAGA and more pro-Trump. And you see this just at looking in the indictment we talked about earlier today, that Trump is totally and fanatically obsessed with loyalty and not quality amongst his staffers. He repeatedly tries to fire the attorney general who is telling him that, you know, these schemes you're trying to enact to overturn the election, they're bad and maybe illegal. Like, he's just constantly trying to install other people who are crazy crackpot cranks. He loves the cranks. He doesn't care if they're cranks because they're loyal. And that's the only thing that he values. And so it's one of those things where, on the one hand, yes, we need a better federal bureaucracy. We need a federal bureaucracy that does not take its employment for granted. We need a smaller and more effective federal bureaucracy that can focus on the things that need to be done. But this particular program is the product of someone who doesn't care about any of those things, but instead only cares about, are there snakes here who are going to be disloyal to me? Are there people who are going to out me and not fully go along with whatever brain fart I come up with in the moment? And I think that that's a real problem. And it just is a reminder that Trump, even if he is doing nominally good things, does them in such a way that they are hard to endorse.
Nick, a civil service brunch or drag queen story brunch?
Oh, yeah. Now, I think all of these, GS5 and above should have to do drag brunches, as part of the package.
I just want to read that David French column on that.
Yeah. Well, he can conduct. He can be the musical director. What's interesting is the federal workforce per capita is lower in absolute numbers than it used to be. And it's about the same per capita as it was under John Kennedy. It went up and has come down. This is not going to make the government smaller or less invasive in our everyday lives. So it's kind of a non-starter. And it's also one of the reasons that James Garfield was assassinated, to put in Chester Alan Arthur, who then passed the Civil Service Reform Act in the 1880s or whatever, that kind of took it out of the spoil system and put it into something approaching contemporary civil service. We need a government that spends less and does less and employs fewer people. Unfortunately, this is not going to get us there.
I will point out that in that Axios piece from 2022, there was the people who were originating this novel interpretation. And again, Trump put an executive order of Schedule F in September 2020, and Joe Biden canceled it on the third day of his presidency, revoked it, whatever. So they were conducting all these interviews at agencies where the people were supposed to, the agencies were supposed to create and find a list of those who could be classified as Schedule F employees, right? So we want a large pool of those so then they could be subject to these kind of tests. And this is quoting from the piece, a red flag went up if a prospective employee answered, when you asked them what they care about or what they thought were the best achievements of the Trump administration. If the prospective employee answered deregulation and judges when asked to name their favorite Trump policies, this was described as a shell of an answer, a sure sign the applicant could be a weak-kneed member of the establishment. That's how that kind of stuff works out in practice. So,
that would have been my answer, by the way, judges and deregulation.
Well, of course. I mean, it's the Butt Gorsuch answer. And, maybe they're right. Those are the people who went soft when we were going to do the coup.
I was always soft. It's not a coup.
I think we finally got a headline for this podcast here. All right. Well, we're getting to our end of podcast time. So let's do our end of podcast. What we have been consuming in the cultural arena. Peter, why don't you go first?
I watched Plane. No, fuck. That's a different thing.
Oh, wait, you actually watched it, though? Because I was like, this is...
No.
I see ads for that all the time, and I'm like, wow, I wonder what it's about.
So, all right. So, Plane is a Gerard Butler movie that I didn't watch, but For the last month and a half, I've been watching an Idris Elba show on Apple TV Plus called Hijack, but I always would refer to it as The Plane Show or The Dumb Plane Show. And that is pretty much my takeaway, is this show has Elba in it, and Elba is great. He's always good, even when the material is bad. Unfortunately, the material here is bad. It's a good setup, because the setup is, what if you had a hijacking on an airplane and there was a guy in first class who is a big deal, deal negotiator between businesses. So he is going to be able to, he's somehow or another going to be able to kind of take charge and like manipulate the hijackers. And his whole strategy is let them think they're in charge, you know, let them think that they're getting the things they want, even though they're actually, you know, he's the one manipulating them, just like you do in big deal, high stakes business deals. And then Elba doesn't actually do very much of that during the show. He mostly just sort of walks around and kind of talks to different parties. It's actually probably more like a real business negotiation, kind of gathers some information while everybody around him acts erratically. And then the more interesting stuff happens on the ground, where you actually get some, you know, British officials, because it's a British plane, talking about whether you have to shoot this thing down or not. The fact that there's even a discussion about that once the plane is literally flying over London is kind of nonsensey, right? Like, these planes, when there are definitely hijackers on board and the plane is definitely flying towards London, unfortunately, the decision that gets made, the policy that's in place in real life, is you shoot that plane down, because we know what happens when you don't. The show is also like built on a fundamentally kind of silly, an implausible premise, which is that the hijackers can get into the cockpit of the airplane to begin with. The way that the scheme they use just isn't at all plausible. Pilots would never unlock or open that door. And so there's just a huge number of implausibilities. Also, the final scheme to profit off of this is based on I'm going to spoil this for you. I'm going to spoil it, but I'm going to spoil it because it's not very smart. Like the scheme is, some guys on the ground are going to bet against the airline. And then when the airline's stock price tanks because the plane either crashes or people find out that it's hijacked, they'll make a lot of money. The thing is, you can't do that because it's all traded on the British exchange, and like the system won't pay you out. They track that stuff I talked to somebody who had some nominal involvement with SEC.
Where's
stuff
the gong?
After 9/11, yeah. And they tracked every single deal where somebody might have profited off of, you know, some of the crashes. Anyway, it's not a very good show. Elba is very good, and sadly, I can only recommend it if you're like sick in bed and just need something that you don't really need to pay attention to.
Check that television show. Nick, I think you agree with me that the only show that can be colloquially referred to as the plane show is Fantasy Island.
That's right.
There's no question about that. Nick, what did you consume, and are you going to fact check it?
I'm not going to fact check it, but I don't have to, because it's widely, it has a lot of fact checks in it. I read Matt Lewis's Filthy Rich Politicians, The Swamp Creatures, Latte Liberals and Ruling Class Elites Cashing in on America. Matt Lewis writes for the Daily Beast and various other places. He's a conservative or right-leaning commentator who has, and he's still keeping it, he has a podcast called Matt Lewis and the News, which is a callback to Huey Lewis and the News, which is like, you know, I love that.
It's a great segment title. It's what it is.
It's just like, I don't know. That would be like, you know, Rudy Valley and the trombones or something. Like, you know, 100 years later, nobody knows who Huey Lewis is anymore. But he had a band called The News. And Matt, of course, you used to do the members only march to all of the hits off of his big album Sports, I'm sure, in the 80s. But Matt Lewis's book is very good, because it is a transpartisan, you know, just look at how wealthy people get, particularly being in Congress, but in other aspects of the government. And it covers everybody from the aforementioned ambassador to Dagon the fish god, Nancy Pelosi, you know, all of the ancient, you know, the Cthulhu ancient ones who run the Senate, as well as people like Ted Cruz, And Matt went to what I think is charitably called like a 10th rate university somewhere in West Virginia. So that means it's all like a one room schoolroom. You know, there's kids from kindergarten to, you know, PhDs at the university he went to in West Virginia. And he is like Ted Cruz and all of the fake Ivy populace in the Republican Party really get under his skin in a very detailed and appreciable, very easy to appreciate way. It's a good book. Again, not necessarily to draw all that many policy conclusions, but we need, you know, sunlight is not a very good disinfectant, you know, it turns out, and neither is ultraviolet light or whatever else Trump was calling for. But this type of book it's very good reading. It's extremely well documented, and it helps us understand the people who purport to care about us and know what our lives are like. And part of what I walked away from this book, and I'm, you know, somebody who grew up lower middle class, is now unbelievably comfortable. And I know that I don't have the hunger that I used to, and I don't understand fully. I think I understand more than most people in my position what it's like to, you know, be making, you know, to be in the 40th percentile for income or something like that. And how do you make life choices, what policies work and don't. But this type of book just helps us understand how out of touch the people who run us really are from the people who are us. So I recommend highly, two thumbs up, Matt Welch, Filthy Rich Politicians by Matt Lewis.
But my God, latte liberals?
Yeah,
are we still doing this?
Yeah, well, that's...
It's 2023. Yeah,
I think that might have been Huey Lewis's last big album. I'm not sure. It's like
I want a new latte.
one that doesn't make me fat.
What have you been consuming?
So over the weekend, I just read a book called Naked Came the Detective. It is a short murder mystery novella. It is written by a friend of mine using a pen name, so I don't know if that's fair to say on this, but it's the most recent thing, a cultural product I've consumed, so I'm going to mention it. It is a sex worker murder mystery, but yes. Unlike most sex worker murder mysteries, the sex worker is not the one who gets murdered. The sex worker is the one who does the solving of the murder. So it's a fun, it's very short, it's 90 pages, it's a little mystery story. It's fun because it sort of turns the tropes about sex worker murder mysteries on its head. And, you know, the protagonist is the sex worker who solves the crime. She's a, you know, fully developed three-dimensional character, not just some sort of a, you know, victim or, you know, stereotype. It really does do a good job of presenting sort of sex workers and the industry in a way that is not your stereotypical way of encountering it in the media or especially in mystery novels. So I liked that and I appreciated that about the book a lot. And it's a really just quick little fun read.
I consumed Nick Gillespie's 60th birthday party in New York City, which is great. It was a public event. I mean, private, public, whatever. It was at a place.
It was a public-private partnership, Matt Welch.
It was.
The
triple P.
Yeah.
And also psychedelics, so it's a 4 P's. It was awesome, and it's notable for something that actually people can look online. So it's not just advertising something that people can't consume. Sarah Rose Siskind put together a marvelous first sort of a tape of everyone talking and saying mostly nice things about Nick, which is kind of gross to watch, to be honest with you. But the thing that was really great was Sarah's own super clip of shit Nick Gillespie says, where she's wearing a black leather jacket and doing Nick impersonations, mostly there for the food humor. But other things that listeners of this podcast will find humorous. So I will happily link that. And it was very, very funny. Some of Sarah's best work.
It was
happy
really
birthday,
well
Nick.
Done. I
exactly,
agree.
Exactly, right?
I agree.
Let's all take a silent moment to thank Nick Gillespie for all of his exertions for the Reason Mothership over the years. Okay, the moment's gone. So thank you all for listening, and go to all of our podcasts, including some that involve Nick Gillespie, at reason.com/podcasts. We also have a new one. We talked about it last week. We're super psyched. Why We Can't Have Nice Things by Eric Boehm, a limited series podcast. Episode 2 premieres on Thursday. It is The Ghosts of Protectionism Past. It's about how parts of the tariff code that haven't been updated in nearly 100 years, it's a century, to make shoes and clothes and other basic necessities more expensive, even though we don't make many of those items in this country anymore because we're not great anymore, frankly. This has a special guest, including Ed Gresser. That's a great name. A former assistant U.S. trade representative who served under Presidents Clinton, Trump, and Biden. And also Pietra Rivoli, thank you for the pronunciation guide, Eric, author of Travels of a T-Shirt in the Global Economy. That's super awesome. Anyways, go check it out. Tune in, subscribe, and please, they exhort you, leave a review. If you love it, hate it, whatever. Just tell us what it is. What you think about it. But anyways, we can't have nice things. Eric Van, go listen to that podcast. And if you like what Reason does as an organization, please consider a tax-deductible donation at reason.com/donate. Okay? We will see you next week. Happy birthday, Nick, and goodbye.